Redbeard's Outfitter is a Mobile, Alabama-based outfitter offering a carefully curated selection of gear and apparel, outfitting you for your next adventure, exploring our world, and building community. We love this local store, and we love supporting folks like them who are building community in the outdoor space. Plus, they have some spectacular apparel for Alabamians and all the gear anyone would need to be ready to enjoy the outdoors. Use promo code TSO for a 20% discount online or visit them in store. Visit redbeardsoutfitter.com for more information. This is The Storied Outdoors, a podcast somewhere between Lewis and Tolkien and Lewis and Clark, finding clarity in the stories we tell and the adventures that shape us.
Welcome to The Storied Outdoors. I am live on location with
pretty rare, with
Brad, and we are at the home of Rob Taylor. A fantastic is probably not even close enough to the word, but incredible photographer and artist, outdoorsman, and just from everything that we've had today, we've had a little bit of tour of the lake around here, and just the ability to kind of see how gentle of a soul this man is, and just a really joy to be around. So we're at the home. We're on some rocking chairs. We've got some birds
chirping.
A big old
front porch, man.
We got a front porch.
Got the ambiance of a 747 flying.
Yeah, we were hoping it was going to be that cedar wax wing, but yeah, you know, 747 came by. But
all good, man. I've got the best seat, man. I'm looking out at my two friends, a new friend and an old friend, and a beautiful lake. And, man, what a beautiful place. We got a tour.
Thank you.
You drove us around, gave us the
tour. I did. I gave you a little bit of the lay of the land out there. And you can probably see I was smiling the whole time.
Yeah,
we just love it out here. We actually did.
We
just love it.
Just taking it all in. What a beautiful place. And I knew you painted, but, man.
Yeah.
Like, prolific. You know, then he says he doesn't sell any of them.
Never sold one.
There's this beautiful one on a wood duck that may or may not be missing whenever I leave.
He doesn't sell them, but they keep going missing.
I haven't kept up with my inventory lately. I need to do that.
So all that to say, welcome to The Storied Outdoors.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm just thrilled to have you guys out here at my little part of paradise or whatever it is, except for the 747s or whatever that come over. So,
wow, what a great setup. You know, when Brad and I pulled in to the area, two hen turkeys flew up, and then some doves flew over. I was like, good grief, we're in paradise.
Like, what are we, just a game preserve out here?
It's like,
amazing.
Yeah,
it was like that movie, you know, we had somebody release the turkeys right when y'all came in.
Well, that was
well timed.
That was very well timed.
Thank you. Thank my neighbor for that.
We'll pay him later.
Yeah.
So, Rob, you're a retired CPA, and you have spent a lot of your time in the outdoors. I want to talk a little bit about your photography.
Okay.
I'm a photographer, just a very amateur photographer. I love wildlife photography, but you have been able to photograph some really beautiful shots of what did you call them? Synchronized fireflies, yeah. and the Milky Way and the Cahaba River and the Cahaba lilies, and you know, you fill in the blank. But what is it about photography that draws you to it?
I think it's just the wonder of being outside in God's creation. Mm. You know, the Milky Way. You know, that's one of my favorite things to photograph. And I go back to you know, my early days as a Christian when I read that verse, the heavens declare the glory of God and the firmament shows his handiwork. And that just really stuck with me. And when I'm out looking at that, it just fills me up inside. Mm. And I never get tired of looking at the stars and the moonrise or whatever. I just love to be out at night seeing the wonder of this universe. So that's one thing. I mean, that's more
that's a good
up, that's more up there, you know, but there's so much, you know, just around this area and other places that I've been, I guess more rooted firmly to the ground, that I just find incredible wonder in. Mm. I sort of slowed down at my age a little bit, and I look down more. I've put in my tagline sometimes on some of my photos, I walk a little and look a lot. Hmm. Because there's so many small wonders if you walk through a forest that I've run into. You know, you saw some of my fossils earlier, and the us discovering the synchronous fireflies. You know, that was just a wonder in itself, that we have that population of this rare type of firefly, you know, basically upstream from here, that we didn't know until maybe 5 or 6 years ago, I guess, that they were even there.
Is that not, that's not how they do it everywhere? Is that just specific to one spot?
In fact, the only place I'd ever heard of it was when I was preparing, I took my family a few summers ago, and we dedicated time to go to the Smokies. Mm-hmm. And we've been trying to go to a national park every chance that we get. And so we said, like, let's start close, drivable, pretty easy to get to the Smokies. And Elkmont, that's one of the things that pops up is
the Elkmont's fireflies.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's actually a different type
of
synchronous firefly. Yeah.
So they do tours and the whole shebang where you come and can experience
it. I haven't seen those. I've seen videos of it. And they sort of twinkle, but then they go off at the same time. And there'll be a pause, as I understand it. And then they'll twinkle again, you know, doing their own thing, and then there'll be a slight pause.
Wow.
These are different.
So walk us through that experience. Okay. Like, what does that look like? I mean, I've never experienced it. I'm fascinated by it.
Well, it's just amazing.
I need to come up here.
You try to think, how in the world is this even possible, that one bug, beetle, whatever, on this side of the forest is now synchronized with something as far through the trees as you can see the other way, so that they are blinking at exactly the same time, the flash on and off at the same time. It's incredible to see, and I hope you guys will come back and see it sometime.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, we've had.
I'm just trying to picture myself in the pitch black dark.
Yeah,
and seeing that like happen, that has to be awe inspiring.
It is. It is, and it's usually what we'll do. We'll get upstream right before dark, before they, you know, start rising, because the display is usually best about the first 30 minutes right after it starts really getting dark, and then they'll rise up and you'll sort of lose sight of it. But when they're first rising off the forest floor, and it's incredible. We've had a YouTube personality, Destin Sandlin with Smarter Every Day.
Every Day.
Yep, he's did an episode related to those fireflies. It's on his channel.
Wow.
It hasn't been aired yet, but we've had, and maybe it won't be, but we had Discovering Alabama crew come out here and do some looking around. And we just love it. We love to share it, but, you know, it's, you never know. Some seasons are better than others. And, I mean, the beetles are in the larva stage right now. They're up there. They're up there all year long. It's just that this is their last stage of life when they actually come out of the forest floor and do their thing for a couple of weeks. And
goodness,
then it starts over again. Yeah.
Incredible.
And like I said, we just found them by accident. We went looking for them. Hmm. We had seen a very few right around here and said, I wonder what's going on upstream. And it was like the 4th of July. It was wonderful.
What a light show, man. Yeah. That's awesome.
Can we geek out a little bit on your camera gear?
Well, you know, this will disappoint you.
Okay.
Because I'm very simple in my approach. The approach that I've used in photography is, there's an old saying, you may have heard it, Brian, of F8 and be there. You know, the important thing is get a good camera setting, but the most important thing is to be where the beauty is going to be.
Mm.
And so I've still got I don't have a mirrorless setup. I've got an old DSLR, Canon 5D Mark III.
Okay.
And some, you know, fairly nice lenses, but I haven't upgraded to the latest stuff that's out there. But golly, people have been taking beautiful photographs for a long time a lot cheaper stuff than I've got.
That's how I am. I've gotten I've gotten gear along the way, but most of, I mean, I started out on a Pentax K1000, fully manual, yeah. Had a little bitty battery that would do the meter, and I learned on that, and I've just slowly gotten things, you know, as I have a little extra money here and there, but yeah, there you can spend as whatever you want.
Yeah, you sure can, and I admire the people that do that, and they're some great friends of mine that I've learned a lot from some of these folks. I've tried to position myself with people a lot smarter than I am. It's not hard to do, by the way, with my level, but the main thing for me is composition and just being at that place at the right time. Just for an example, I had been eyeing a spot up at Little River Canyon for a couple of years, across from the main walkway at the waterfall there. And there's no path to it, but I used a particular app and a hike one day and said, you know, there's the potential for an amazing Milky Way photograph this time of year, just this time of year, at that location. And so two friends of mine went up there earlier this week and stood in the cold, and it was magic at that spot.
Well, you say that, you know, being there, the places that you go and the times that you get there are not always just, let me run by there and let me get there on my way home from work.
No. You swing in there and snap a couple pictures.
Yeah. These are places that you've worked really hard to get there, and probably a lot of darkness.
Yes. You are so right. In fact, one of the things that we love to do is waterfalls at night.
Yeah. I've seen your pictures, and they're amazing.
You can you can go to a place that's very familiar to individuals, like DeSoto Falls. Mm-hmm. But to hike there at night and you know, add a little bit of lighting to it, and it just so happens that the Milky Way is in the background, you know, arching over the waterfall. Mm. That's pretty special. And you know, when you've done that not many other people have actually, you know, taken the effort to do that. Yep. I'm sure some people have, but it's a wonderful feeling to be there, not because, gosh, we're the first, but because this is incredibly personal and special to me and the people that I photograph with. It is a priceless moment. And when you see, you feel God under your feet as you walk down the trail, you know, as you push the thorns out of the way, you know, I mean, it's all part of the experience, but it just lights up your inside when you're at that particular spot at that time.
Robin, you said the people you photograph with. So, are you usually, when you're doing stuff like that, are you in a, usually not solitary? Is that usually sometimes with a group when you're doing some of those trips?
Well, the things around this lake, I'm usually by myself, but I've got a great friend of mine, Ron Burkett, who is far ahead of me in terms of ability. He's somebody that I've traveled to Iceland 3 times with Ron. Another friend of ours, Skip Pennington, we've been to Antarctica. And, so it's great to have that person with you that you can, you know, share the joy with at that moment. Of course, you know, and I've got to mention Rhonda, my wife. Mm-hmm. Rhonda will get up and she will go. You know, we'll be leaving the house about 5:30 tomorrow morning to heading for Bankhead, and we'll be ready to roll. And it's a wonderful experience, and I just love hiking with her.
So. Wow.
Robin, as we were here and you gave us a little tour of the house, you started getting into a story about this lake and how you ended up here. And you're showing this amazing collection of lures that you collect.
Award-winning collection.
I mean, this is incredible. And I felt a good, like a good story coming. So I was like, Rob, hold on. Let's hold on to that story.
I guess we'll find out if it's a good story.
Had the makings of a good story. And I was like, let's hold off on that. But now we're here, and we're sitting around this beautiful lake. How did you guys land here?
Well, my dad had a business associate that he worked with named Mr. Whiteside when I was in my formative years. And he had Mr. Whiteside owned this property where we're sitting right now. And he had asked Dad to come and fish with him because they would come out here and when the brim were bedding and stuff like that and just slay them. And so I got to come one time, and then there was a point in terms of the lure connection where one night my dad said, Mr. Whiteside wants us to come over to his house. And I said, well, why? He said, well, he just wants us to come over to his house. So we popped in the Biscayne, I think it was at the time, a Chevy Biscayne, and went over to Mr. Whiteside's place. And when we're sitting there and he's talking, he says, you like to fish and all this? And I said, yes, sir, I just love it. He starts pulling out these tackle boxes with old lures in them. And he says, I want you to have these. And one of the lures that caught my attention was a creek chub beetle, which mm-hmm. is what I specialize in collecting. It was green and it was ugly and it had a worm burn on it, if you can remember burns. But I just was fascinated by it because it was not shaped like the other lures. It was like a minnow. It was shaped like a big bug. And a ridiculously big bug, but it just hit me.
They are huge, like
the size of your thumb.
Yeah.
So anyway, that one's just sort of always fascinated me. I never really fished with it that much. But from that, Mr. Whiteside sold this property to my dad. And from there, when he passed on, he was going to retire out here, but he passed on at age 55. Eventually it came to me. So Rhonda and I built a house out here in the early 90s, and this is where we've stayed. But Mr. Whiteside was a fascinating man. Besides the tackle boxes with a line and all that, were several Winchester bamboo fly rods.
Oh, man.
Mm. And unfortunately, I didn't know what the heck I was doing. And I popped the tops out of them, just using them. Yeah. I was a kid, I was 14 years old, 14, 15.
We collected fishing rods. We're going to fish with fishing rods.
That's what I did. That's what I did with them. I think both of them came with extra tips, but that didn't matter. But that really got me more fly fishing. And when I said at that time, when he gifted those boxes to me, we were still living at East Lake. And that was right across the alley from our house. And I would take those Winchester fly rods over there and just fly fish every afternoon, just about, if I wasn't doing sports or whatever. And I'd throw anything that I could attach to the end of those things and chunk it out there. From mealworms to red worms to flies that were way too big. But I caught a lot of fish with them, and I loved it, and I started tying some flies. I don't do that anymore, and that's a regret of mine, but I got an old herder's fly tying kit and a fly vise and started coming up with my own stuff for a while. I was a fly fisherman for a while. Untrained, still am.
Well, I mean, I don't know how to describe the collection. Cases and cases of these bugs. How many do you have?
I don't know. I have no idea. I have no idea. Too many.
I have too many.
Yeah.
I didn't even like. There's this row of cases. I'm like, what the world's in there? And then I looked over on the table when we were coming into your area, and I was like, oh, that's what those are. I was like, where do you even buy cases for that many lures? Did you have those?
Yeah.
Built?
Well, I'm at a fishing lure collectors club, and so they're individuals that meet the needs of collectors, and so.
Again, something I didn't know existed.
Yeah.
Fishing Lures Collectors
the
Club.
National Fishing Lures Collectors Club.
There you go.
And they have annual conventions, and there's a couple of hundred people just like, well, I'd say just like me. But more serious than I would ever dream about being about fishing lures. And there's some
fanatics.
There's some pricey stuff that goes on.
Really?
But it's an amazing experience when you get there.
Well, I love the display, and also
they're beautiful. The displays are really the boxes and cases are even beautiful to me. I like woodwork and stuff like that. It's really cool.
Yeah, and you got these 1920 advertisements that you've got posted around. I mean, I love old stuff. I mean, and
I do too. And I guess it's cool. The artist in me that appreciates that old. Those types of posters like that.
Mm-hmm. I just think the trouble you were showing us the stamps, the basically the blocks, the printer blocks,
printing blocks that they use for the catalogs.
They're so intricate, and like the skill that it took to make those alone is incredible to me.
Yeah, and the stages that they went to just to make a lure at that time was amazing compared to the stuff that, you know, that works and we fish with today. And I've got a whole bunch of it, you know, the plastic stuff. But I mean, you know, these were lathed and then sanded and so those primed.
Those are wooden.
They're supposed to let up to 12 coats of paint on each of those creek chub lures.
Gracious.
To protect What's the them.
Primary, was that like a balsa? What kind
it's
of wood?
It's white oak.
White oak. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Balsa, is that what they would use like on a popper?
Mm-hmm. That's really light. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. They used a Rapala when they had their lures were balsa also. And they would tear out, the hooks could tear out of them sometimes. They had a wire reinforcement, I think, in some of them. But you won't tear the hooks out of these.
Not out of a white oak.
Oh, no. And it's, you know, the other thing that fascinated me was just the difference of the colors. That's what I have is basically a color collection. Mm-hmm. And the artistry of what they call the paint ladies at that time in their factory, you know, it was just amazing how accurate they were.
To say this is not like a machine painted lure. These are hand painted, right?
And they've got real mother of pearl spinners on the ends of those beetles. Wow. You know, you'll see that much anymore.
That's meant for guitars, man. That's
That's right.
He's got quite the collection.
He's got some good looking guitars.
Brad picked up a couple of them, played a little bit.
Yeah, he just made me feel bad about my abilities after he
come on now.
Did a few things on that. These old fingers aren't as fast as they used to be. So
hell, I'm sure mine will slow down one day. Mm. Man,
I still enjoy it.
Yes. Well, again, like going back to the artistry of even making, you know, the making of guitars. I mean, they're just to have them, several of them sitting on stands to me they're beautiful. You know, it's just like, you know, not unlike seeing all those lures. That's pretty neat.
Now, I'm probably the only person that does this, but sometimes I'll just pick it up and just smell the sound hole. Stick my nose in there and just smell that wood.
It just feels
good.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
When you think about, I love the process of getting to places like you were getting to places to shoot photography, you know, say at night, you know, and the work involved in getting there and the commitment to get there. And then the patience that comes with like waiting on, you know, the right moments or the right time or, you know, and getting everything set up for shooting at night. That's pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Talk about like what that does in you as an artist, going that whole process of going and waiting and creating that photograph.
Well, that's really, I guess, what I'm in love with more than the image. I mean, that's the image, the photograph is like the final, you know, revelation of what's been a long process for me. And if you were to go with us and see what's involved, I mean, the night hikes, you know, we're using flashlights and headlamps and we're walking, you know, a mile or more or 2 miles, whatever, and we don't know, everything looks different at night. You get there, okay, it's dark. So how are we going to arrange lights to be subtle? You know, you don't want it to look artificial when you're doing that. So there's a lot of experimentation, I will say, art or whatever involved in that. A lot of creativity in how we're going to place lights, if we're even going to use a light or not. And that process is very enjoyable. And not stepping on a snake, you know, is also an enjoyable part of it.
Yeah,
that
is.
But it's that whole creative process, which I've found I get more immediate feedback from digital photography than, say, you know, with a paintbrush or a slide film or whatever. So I do really enjoy that. But, you know, every night's different. When we were at Little River earlier this week, we didn't need any supplemental lighting. And the moon wasn't out. It was starlight. And coupled with a long exposure and, you know, the camera settings and things like that provide the illumination for our photographs. I mean, it was very involved. I mean, it wasn't like, you know, pointing and shooting at a rainbow or a butterfly or something like that. I mean, there was some patience. When your exposure settings don't work and things like that, and you had to keep trying. But there was just also a pure feeling of joy at being on that rock at 3:30 in the morning and just having this view to yourself or with a, you know, a close friend. Mm. That was it's priceless. Mm. That's the only way I can say it. It's just priceless. You know, besides my friend, I knew that, you know, we were in the presence of the Lord. We're looking up and seeing this majesty of the sky. And I know this is a podcast. I'm supposed to say things, but sometimes you just can't explain what you're seeing. Mm. It's that good. It's just that fulfilling inside of you. Mm-hmm. So,
I feel like as an artist, you see the world in a unique way, and you pick up on things, and you see the little things and the intricate details. I mean, you can tell by the way that your paintings turn out. I mean, every stroke looks intentional, and it's just, I don't know. It's a beautiful way of displaying these observations. But what do you feel like is kind of the root of your creativity? Like, where does that come from?
I wish I knew. I was blessed to have, you know, a family that was sort of drawn to the creative, you know, pursuits. Even my dad, when he was an accountant also, mm-hmm. you know, he would talk about the creativity of what he was doing with, you know, advising clients and things mm-hmm. like that, you know, on, but with, you know, he could paint when he wanted to. My uncle Pete was, I thought he did an excellent job. My uncle Bo painted. And, you know, when you're around that growing up, and seeing their commitment and their joy in doing it, it just sort of gets into you. I can't say it's genetic. I can't say it's not genetic.
Did they do anything to encourage that in you at a young age?
Well, positive feedback would be one thing. You know, yeah. There's a kind word and then a pat on the back does a lot, you know, for a youngster, for sure. But other than that, I don't know. I guess
the reason I ask is because, yeah. You know, my son is interested in drawing. Brad, your daughter is a very talented painter and an artist. And I just want to encourage that. How do you encourage that in a child to continue to pursue those?
And I think they need to see you doing it and mm-hmm. see that you enjoy doing it and share your success, if that's what you want to call it. And provide them with the tools also. You know, that was one thing we never minded spending money on with our kids. My daughter and my son have painted also, and they're very creative. But, you know, if they needed a pad of paper or pens or whatever, you know, we tried to make sure that they had it.
Yeah.
You know, a 64 box of Crayola crayons, you got it. You know, and you move up from there, so... That's sort of, I guess that's the only way I can explain it. But mm-hmm. I think, you know, positive feedback and encouraging word goes a long way. But there may be a genetic component to it that I don't know about.
Yeah.
Can you contrast, though they're similar in capturing of images, photography and painting? Seem to kind of go hand in hand together, but they're very different. Can you contrast those two and, like, maybe some things you love about the two of them?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier with the photography, I like the, especially with digital, I like the immediate, you know, feedback that I get.
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to process and fine tune the images after we've taken them a little bit. But there is that immediacy as looking at the back of a camera and mm-hmm. seeing what your image is. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing for photography. And, you know, messing with the composition that's involved. That's, I think if I have any strength, it's more the compositional side of things, mm-hmm. or coming up with the ideas as opposed to actually the execution that's involved. So that's the photography side of thing. For the painting, I've just really seen what other folks have done. And it inspires me, and it makes me want to try to not to copy, but to try to emulate and learn from what they have they might have done. I'm horrible to take to the Birmingham Museum of Art because I want to get closer than the guard evidently wants me to get to the painting.
It's frowned upon.
sir, please step back, sir.
Albert Bierstadt, you know, you're too close, Mr. Taylor. Take a step back or two. Because I want to see how the layers of the paint are. Mm. You know, there's a luminous quality that some of these artists have achieved that I can't come close to, you know, with the way they did everything and the size, the scope of some of these canvases. So that really pulls me into it. I'll never be there, but I'm going to keep trying, and I get the sense of satisfaction when my wood duck comes out okay, or a hummingbird. You know, we're waiting on the hummingbirds right now to show up, and if you've followed my photography, I love to photograph the hummingbirds, and we'll have...
You'll feed them out of your hand, won't you?
Yes, I will.
Wow.
Yes,
that's
I will.
Pretty amazing. That's there's a guest that we had on a while back. Crazy that it was that long ago, but it was like season two, Ben King.
Oh, yeah.
Ben's a retired pro cyclist. I watched him race on...
Okay.
He raced the Tour de France, but he's a very, very gifted wildlife photographer. But he just recently had a set of his hummingbird photos turned into stamps, like stamp series, which I thought was, like, I don't know what that process is like, but that seems very prestigious.
Oh, that sounds very prestigious to me.
Man, they were incredible. Yeah. They were really beautiful photographs of hummingbirds. Some of my favorite. That was one of my dad's favorite things to photograph was hummingbirds. And I just love to see those things, you know, what they do and how... You know, getting up close to them with the cameras, really neat to see how intricate they are.
I've chased them around this neighborhood before. I've been taking pictures of the sunrise when they've been up in the pine trees above me, I guess, getting gnats or whatever before they would find a more convenient feeder. But we put out the feeders on this porch to try to draw them to us, and then we'll put out flowers and plants and things like that to keep them interested in coming here. And that makes the photography part of it a little bit easier, but it's still very challenging for me.
You know, talking about your paintings, and you were saying, like, well, I'm not there yet. Brian and I you were showing us the fireflies one, which is beautiful. And I looked over on the wall next to it, and there's a couple of birds there, one of them being a hummingbird. I thought they were photographs.
I did too. I thought that's a great picture.
I painted that. I was like, "You what? You painted that?"
In my eyes, you're there.
If I got right up on it, I realized, "Oh, that is a painting," but I couldn't tell.
Well, that's very kind of you.
Incredible, yes.
And I'm geared more toward realism to the extent that I can achieve it than more the more impressionistic side of things. But that's. I guess it's an imitation of nature. I don't know. That's just what I do.
Wow. You know, I don't know if I told you this or not, Brad. One time we were at the lake in Lake Gunnersville, and a baby hummingbird was on the water, and its wings were too wet to lift itself up. And so we paddled over there, and I got it in my hand and kind of put it like on a towel just to kind of let it pat dry a little bit. And it got, you know, we put it on a limb, and the limb and the bird, you know, it stayed there for 45 minutes or so. Yeah. And then it flew off. And then we were all sitting on the porch that night, and that little baby and the mom perched on a limb, like right in front of our porch, as if to say,
wow,
thank you.
Now, mom.
Yeah. And it was like, oh.
There they are, Mom.
There they are. Yeah. You know? So
They'll never believe me.
See, that was the hand that lifted me out of the water. But it was cool. I mean, they're so smart, and I do think that they do. I think I've heard that they have facial recognition, and they can
really.
My face, I feel sorry for him, but
maybe they were like, "See, well, I told you how ugly he was."
Yeah. Well, when we'll, you know, it took a while. When we first started putting the feeders out, for me to get them to come to a hand feeding position or whatever, but I had to get closer slowly. And I think facial recognition and the fact that I wasn't a threat sort of worked their way into some of them. And now when they come back every year, I mean, they'll live for 4 or 5 years is what I've heard, unless something happens to them, it doesn't take that long now for them to start, you know, eating out of my hand with nectar in the palm of my hand or holding a little feeder. Wow. So it's like that bird remembers me from last year. I don't know. I'm not a scientist on that, but it works, you know.
Yeah. They fly so far, like south.
Yeah.
Yeah. Central America.
They would come back, you know, they come back and would, you know, make it all the way back here. And then
to this spot.
Yeah.
Where I'm sitting, where we're sitting right now.
Yeah.
They've come that far and they know to come here.
That's
a God thing right there too, you know. There's no way to.
That's not chance.
Accident? It can't possibly be.
Chance? Really?
There's some programming going on there from on high. But it's just, just another wonder, and just to see these things do what they do. And, you know, they don't always get along, but, you know.
Oh, yeah, they're feisty.
They are.
You know. We'll dive bomb each other.
But then they'll do that, and then they'll sit right next to each other and sip nectar together. So you never know.
That's funny. My mom, because Dad loved him, we had lots of feeders on our porch. I grew up in Monroeville, Alabama. Okay. And so they'd have lots of feeders, and they had one. This wasn't long after Dad had passed away, and it got caught in one of those banana spider web.
Oh, big ones.
Big ones. Yeah, she had some flowers and I think an azalea. And so it had a kind of a right below one of the feeders, and it had a big web there, and it had been caught there, and it was struggling and struggling. Of course, it exhausted itself.
Yeah,
and so she was able to get it out of the the web and kind of get it delicately clean, you know, the web off of its wings, because even the web would weight it down and entangle it up, and so. And it was so exhausted, it was just like it wanted to flee, but it couldn't because it was just tired. Yeah. And but she was able to like get it cleaned off, and it just kind of sat there. And she put a little of that, you know, the nectar like in her hands, and it fed. And it took it a little while.
Wow!
But it finally, you know, it flew off, and it was it was just really cool. I mean, she was talking about like how Dad would have really loved that, but just seeing them up close like that, and then. She's like how light it was.
Oh, yeah. You can't even feel the weight of it in your just hand. Mirror. It's like an eighth of an ounce or something.
Yeah,
point
something ounces. Yeah. You know, unbelievable. And then those things fly to South America.
Yeah.
Like, how are they not blown up, you know, all over creation by, you know, gale force winds?
I don't understand it. I'm thankful for it, though.
It's
another wonder of creation that just sinks itself into your soul, you know, when you see. When you see that happening, we've had for example, the feeder that is behind me that only you two can see right now is hanging like that because we've had rat snakes come up these posts and actually take one off of a feeder before.
Oh, so wow. Are you serious?
I'm serious because I lost one because of that.
Whoa!
It was. Just very quiet. It was not that big, but it was evidently quick. When I heard the distress call of a hummingbird, which sinks its way into your soul, and I wasn't in time to rescue it.
Wow!
And we've had an issue with raccoons that love the nectar, and I've got photos from our game camera that we put on the porch of them reaching out and pulling the feeders over and sipping the nectar out of it. So. He tried to put them out of reach now.
Robin's
so.
Got some diabetic diabetic raccoons around here.
I do. They're fun to watch.
By his weird insulin pump.
You getting any more nectar?
I've been hitting the old feeders a little too hard lately.
Well, I've heard that their tongues are so tiny. And I guess what's going into the hole there. And ants will bite the tongue, and that will keep the hummingbird from being able to come bring
I've
it
never
out.
Heard that.
And
wow.
Like, so you have to kind of watch for ants around your feeders because it's dangerous for them to.
Yeah, because I guess it'd be so small that if it like swole up at all, like it could get.
Yeah. We've had problems until the last couple of years with carpenter ants and ants getting on the feeders.
Oh, yeah.
And now we use moats. You know, so like a little cup of water that is just...
Is that what that is?
Yes, I think that's what's behind me there, that is supposed to protect the feeder from the ants, because supposedly the ants don't swim.
Yeah.
But I have a video I can show you sometime if you were interested in seeing how they used a boat to cross the moat.
Interesting.
Yeah.
They're smart
animals. It's unbelievable.
They're smart
animals. It's unbelievable, but the ants
are
getting on.
You're making it up.
That's why I video most everything.
Yeah, it's
for moments like that.
That's funny.
But we just love them. We love the hummingbirds coming and the fireflies. We're very fortunate to have access to that kind of natural wonder where we are.
You talk about the things that are around here that you find so much wonder and beauty in, but you also kind of drop the fact that you went to Antarctica.
And I wouldn't try to just be a name dropper.
I know. I want to hear about that story, though.
Snuck that in there.
I want to hear, what was that like? I mean, let's talk about...
That's a
serious adventure.
That's an adventure.
That's not going to South America.
I'm
going to
take all the adventure out of it. There was a day when we were in Antarctica in January of 2015, I think it was, when it was warmer there than it was in Trustful.
Really? Wow. I would have never guessed it.
Yeah. It was summer in Antarctica.
Oh.
So, but we landed in Ushuaia on the southern tip of Argentina and took a ship across the Drake Passage, which is notorious for rough seas.
Yeah.
But it was the Drake Lake when we went across. They called it the Drake Lake. Yeah, it still got me a little bit, but and then we
Did you get a little motion sickness?
Yeah, I did.
Yeah.
But once we got to Antarctica, you're basically in protected waters along the coastline, and it was gorgeous. We did the land excursions and saw the penguins and the walruses and the whales and the whole deal.
Gosh, that sounds amazing.
It was. You didn't need color film that much, I'll tell you that, because it was...
I bet so.
It was a lot of white, but it was glorious, and I was glad I had the opportunity to do that trip.
Wow.
So,
what does... we often kind of ask this question. What is a place that you've been that's just kind of stopped you in your tracks at the beauty of God's creation?
Gosh, it's hard to just name one.
Mm.
I think Zion National Park is one that
bucket list
really fills your soul. We did the Angel's Landing hike. Ron and I did. He'd done it before, but to be on the top up there after the torturous or whatever you want to call it path to the top, and just seeing the red rocks and the greenery around you, and it's hard to put into words. It just feels like this is where I'm supposed to be at this moment in time. And I'd love to go back and do it again. Now, I've been to Yosemite before. I'd love to spend more time there, and it has that tunnel view of Yosemite Valley is something that you don't forget. Also,
that's the place I want to go fish. Yeah. I'd love to fish one day.
Yeah.
But, you know, there's so many wonderful places right here in Alabama that, you know, you got to put boots on. You're going to get your feet wet. You may slip down a few times, but, you know, you talk about Bankhead National Forest. You talk about a lot of hidden wonders in Little River Canyon that, you know, you can't just stay in the car or walk to the overlooks to experience those things. You've got to get out and go. But
you're saying they're not found on the couch?
No, they're not. Nope.
Got to get out and go.
Got to get out there and go.
Or through your power window.
No. Yeah.
just crazy stuff here, and I just love it. Of course, we love our neighborhood too.
But
I was going to say. I mean, you listed off or rattled off a list of wildlife just in this little area that you've observed. Yes. What are some of your favorites you've observed right here in your little neighborhood?
Well, the things that we've seen on the game cameras, you know, I don't have trouble with a bear being in the neighborhood myself, mm-hmm. but we've only seen them on the game cameras. I haven't seen one in person, but we've got the pictures of them. I think I've heard the bobcats, but that's okay if I don't see the bobcats. There's probably a few things I haven't seen that are around in these woods. You never know.
I thought I just heard a turkey.
Turkey. Is there a turkey? Is it possible there's a turkey over here?
Well, you can hear from across the lake too.
I heard it. Yeah.
It sounded like it was just right over there.
Could be. Could be. I used to.
Somebody heard one on the road next to me because I practiced my turkey call in the Jeep.
I was shooting sunrise one morning, and there was a competition between the turkeys and the Canada geese in terms of noise. And it's a wonderful sound. You know, yeah. I love hearing the turkeys.
I love being in the woods and listening to the world wake up.
Oh yes,
that's something that if you've never done that, you need to do it in the springtime and just get out on a cool morning and just sit and listen, and it's amazing just the way you'll hear a rustle here and then a bird start chirping and then you'll hear something, a turkey gobble in the distance and then an owl hoot and then it's fascinating to just listen to the world
just
wake up.
Hear the world wake up like that. There's no reruns,
no,
you know, like on television or whatever. It's new every morning. And I sort of gave y'all a hint at the number of years I've been coming out here, and I've never had a bad morning or a rerun on the sunrise or the sunset. It's just wonderful.
I mean, his mercies are new, right? Every morning.
Absolutely.
And so goes creation waking up. I mean, it's just new every day, and it's beautiful. I mean,
yeah.
Just, man, even sitting out here, this afternoon is so just relaxing and good for your soul. Yeah.
Well, when we were driving, we went by what it said, the nature trail, it's just 0.8 mile of a round trip up through there. But, most of the time it's either me alone or Rhonda and I walking together. And it's just a wonderful quiet time for reflection. And sometimes you just stop and just absorb what's going on around you, and I should stop more. I should look down more.
There's studies that prove, being in a place like this out in the woods, lowers your blood pressure.
Yeah.
And so, I can imagine living in a place like this would lower your blood pressure. But even sitting out here on this porch this afternoon has been just a great, unplugging for me a long week. I work at a church, and sometimes weeks can be long and rough, in pastoral work. But even, you said, well, it's time for y'all to go to work, when we were getting out after the tour and we're going to set up and record the podcast. And me and Brian says, man, I've experienced a lot of work, but this ain't it.
This is enjoyable.
This is so enjoyable, to get out and sit on a porch like this and on a spring afternoon like this and share stories this is good for the soul.
It's good for me to have you guys out here to just bounce thoughts off of and just share the joy that we both have, we all three have in this creation that we're blessed to be able to share together.
So. You mentioned a few times when we were driving around the lake about reflection I've come out here a lot of times and reflected on things. Talk about that and the value of reflection and how that, that importance in your life. What does that look like?
Well, it's not necessarily a reset, because I think you're the sum of all the things that have happened in your life. But I think that quiet time where you're in a place with, this will sound weird since there's so much going on in the natural world, but you can sort of escape some of the distractions of, I won't say civilization, I hated to say it that way too, but there's just time alone in the forest that I think you can't get anywhere else. Maybe the high desert, where regardless, you can just tune everything else out and be a part of the vast quietness that's out there in the woods sometimes. And I think that's a very cleansing and fulfilling experience, to just stop and think, pray, look around, and just let all those types of things just sort of meld in together. And I feel like after one of those morning walks, maybe it doesn't last that long. Sometimes it lasts longer than others, but I'm better for it. Mm-hmm. And I think cumulatively, I'm better for having those times like that. I'm walking a lot slower than I used to, not because of necessarily the age, but because it gives me more time for, you know, reflection and counting blessings, or however you want to, you know, define it for yourself. But it's priceless. Priceless time.
Yeah, I think about you know, what you just said earlier about the slowing down,
yeah,
and kind of taking things in. Yeah, we try to talk a lot about legacy on this podcast, and the way that we want to pour into our children. You know, Brad and I both have children. Mm-hmm. You have children, grandchildren, and the things that we want to leave them with. What would you want to your grandchildren and your children to remember or to take away from your life as a, this is the yeah, most important thing?
I hope they will be able to always say, Pa, that's what they call me.
Pa?
Pa. Pa loved me, and Pa always had time for me.
Hmm.
And that's about it. We've had some wonderful times together, and I know we're going to have more. So
I think that speaks a lot about the intentionality that you have with the things that you put your hands to and the relationships that you, yeah, have. I feel like that always had time, always having time for your children, mm-hmm, your grandchildren. That seems to be true of just the short amount of time that I've gotten to know you through, you know, Instagram or, yeah, or through just our visits today. It feels like there's a level of intentionality that you live with that really shines through.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. And, you know, I speak words of what I hope that they'll be able to say. But I always know that, you know, there are times when I've been my humanity, I, you know, fall short,
mm-hmm,
you know, or whatever. But that happens in so many areas of anybody's life.
Yeah.
And, but that's what I want, and that's what I'm striving for.
Mm.
I'm blessed with a wonderful wife, wonderful kids, wonderful grandkids, and it just fills me up and makes me want to just to pour out back to them and thank the Lord every day for this wonderful gift that I've been given and trusted in a way also.
Well, as we toured around at part of this lake, you not far up from here, and that, well, there was a little sign on the road. You're like, well, that's not the official one, but like the headwaters of the Cahaba. And we've talked to lots of people as guests on the, yep, podcast, you know, who spend time on the Cahaba, who, yep, work on the Cahaba, who fish the Cahaba. Mm-hmm. The Cahaba lilies are point of, you know, photography and paintings,
yep,
and conversations. So the headwaters are here, not far from your home.
Well, there's a sign for the headwaters not far from here. I think, you know, I don't know why the state of Alabama or whatever put the sign there, unless it's the northernmost part, because I think the headwaters themselves are like, you know, fingers that come together, mm-hmm, and eventually form,
I see,
you know, the Cahaba. But there is a sign there that we claim it, since there's an official sign there that says that,
well, I mean,
you know,
this is part of, sign, I mean,
yeah, it's, you know, what can you say? Here's your sign. We claim it, and somebody else can claim another part. I think we're all right. we're all right there. And I love the Cahaba. We've had people do wildlife studies out here and, you know, aquatic studies on this section of the river here for the crawfish and the darters and things like that they have found in here.
So, now, would you have as far up here, did you have red eye in here?
No.
No. Those would only be like in the stream?
I've never caught a bass upstream because it's about 10 feet deep. I mean, 10 feet wide and 8 inches deep, probably, except for a couple little pools. Mm. And I think if there is a fish, it's come from the lake above. So I wish there were. It's
they're pretty cool fish.
Yeah.
Love those little
someday.
Fish.
But before I moved here, and the time in Selma, I was living in this area of Birmingham. And my house was near the Cahaba there, too. So I spent a lot of time out below 280, Highway 280, on that stretch of the Cahaba River. Yeah. And so there's always been sort of a love for water, love for lakes, love for these streams. And if I have anything to do with it, it's always going to be there. You know, I never get tired of tromping and wading in these creeks and probably acting a little silly sometime, but it just it just fills me up.
Well, the one of the questions that we love to ask our guests is, what's your next adventure? And I think I know the answer. It sounds like it's going to happen about 5:30 in the morning.
5:30 in the morning. I don't have where we're going to the total solar eclipse.
Going to go in the path?
We're going to Waco.
Okay.
Which, you know, is sort of seems to be a place of pilgrimage now for a lot of people to go to Waco, but it just so happens that Totality's going over there. So we'll be out there in, 3 weeks or so, I guess. And
April 8th, I think.
Yeah. 6, 7, 8, 9, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I just know we're going to be there.
Well,
to the annular eclipse in New Mexico last year. You know, when you've got the moon is a little bit smaller than the disk of the sun, so you get the ring of fire around it.
Yeah.
And that was pretty cool. Yeah.
Was that in the fall?
Yeah.
So we were recording the 100th episode with Jimbo Metter.
Jimbo Metter.
And the eclipse was happening while we were walking around his property.
He was doing some funky things with the reflections.
Yeah.
And the shadows.
The shadows were all crescent moons.
Yeah, we were in the Visty Badlands of New Mexico.
Oh, my goodness.
And, we were not alone, by the way. But, there was elbow room.
A couple people there?
Just a couple. And you think you're nowhere, and you are nowhere, but everybody
nowhere
else is out there. You're nowhere with a bunch of someones. Yeah.
I had a friend just the other day talk about he was going over to Temple, Texas, and they've already declared it a national emergency because it's going to double in population.
I asked Chase about that. That's
Chase is from. Yeah,
good friend of mine's a pastor at Temple Temple Bible.
So we're staying outside of the area of Totality just because it was a lot cheaper.
Yeah,
you know,
I would imagine.
And then we'll just drive in for it out.
That'll be fascinating. I hope you get some good photos.
Well, thanks. We went to the one a few years ago that came through Murfreesboro, and so my pictures will probably look just like those pictures.
But the experience will be different.
But the experience will be different.
There
That's
you
right.
Go.
You know, it's just being there.
Wow.
Like I say, I enjoy it.
Well, Rob, thank you so much. You've given up so much of your time today, and just a joy to sit and relax in a beautiful setting. And, man, if I had had a camera on me, it would have looked like I was a Labrador chasing a squirrel with my eyes. All of the birds that were flying by, and me being a birder, it just feels like a little bit of paradise out here.
Well, I just feel honored to have you guys out here, and hope that we can do it again, and you'll come back, and maybe have a fishing rod.
I want to see those fireflies.
I do too, man. That's so cool.
Yeah.
Well, I will let you know.
Thank you.
All right, bring the kids.
That's
whatever.
Leah would lose his mind with a synchronized lightning bugs or fireflies, whatever you want to call them. I think we call them lightning bugs in Mobile.
Yeah, they're Photurus frontalis, I think is the scientific name, but we just call them snappy sinks or synchronous fireflies. And it's anybody that's seen them that's been out here has said, wow, that's unbelievable. That's what they do. Yeah.
That's probably what I would say.
Yeah.
Yep.
What else can you say?
I took the words right out of my mouth.
Yeah.
Well, what a fun conversation and just a great time to sit and visit and, you know, capture stories and lives that love the outdoors like you and have are willing to share with us your stories and your thoughts. We never know who's going to be listening and who will be challenged or who will be encouraged to pick up their camera and start taking photos or pick up a paintbrush and start to look deeply and begin to paint and capture and experience that kind of art and outdoors sort of mixed together. I love that combination of capturing those, and the realism of your paintings are beautiful. And
thank you very much.
I love the thought of, I think we talked with Breezy Brookshire about just painting and drawing anything in the outdoors and trying to capture realism does cause us to move slower and to really look deeper at something in the shadows and the way the light hits it. And so it's such a great practice, and man, I hope this inspires some folks to do that. And it's what we say. I love it. To write their own stories and share their own adventures in the place we love to call the storied outdoors.
Redbeard's Outfitter is a Mobile, Alabama-based outfitter offering a carefully curated selection of gear and apparel, outfitting you for your next adventure, exploring our world, and building community. We love this local store, and we love supporting folks like them who are building community in the outdoor space. Plus, they have some spectacular apparel for Alabamians and all the gear anyone would need to be ready to enjoy the outdoors. Use promo code TSO for a 20% discount online or visit them in store. Visit redbeardsoutfitter.com for more information.